Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
I'd like to welcome you all to the Tattered Cover Bookstore, and thank you for supporting your locally owned and independent businesses. You know, I'm not sure what to say tonight. I was almost going to completely wing it with my introduction, but I am so incredibly excited to introduce this evening's guest speaker, the one and only Mary Roach. So excited that I was ready to fight every other event host to be here tonight. And she thinks I'm kidding, but I'm really not. I signed up for this like 6 months ago. So if you're here, you already love her, whichever is your favorite, whether it's Bonk, Stiff, Spook, or Packing for Mars. You know, Roach manages to take us where we didn't know we wanted to go, and even just a little bit further than that. But it's always funny, always entertaining, and of course, always informative. So she's here tonight to present her newest in scientific exploration and investigation with Gulp, Adventures of the Elementary Canal. So without further ado, please join me in giving a warm welcome to Miss Mary Roach.
Hello. Thank you. Thank you. And sorry to keep you waiting a little bit. I had a little bit of a mix-up. I got in the courtesy car of my hotel, and I said, Tattered Cover, and they said, the downtown. I went, yeah, downtown. Yeah, not the suburban one, downtown. So I went, and I show up, and there are all the chairs there, and there's nobody there yet. It's 10 past 7, and I'm like, wow, it's kind of a quiet evening. And as it turns out, there is an author. There's some author talking about who's going to show up and talk about the situation in Afghanistan. And I thought, well, let's just swap, you know, and I'll talk about Afghanistan. You can go over to the Colfax one and talk about farts. So, but anyway, I managed to make it here. So thank you. Sorry, I'm a little late. Anyway, I am happy to be back here. And it's such a great bookstore. And for those of you who aren't familiar with me, I should just sort of warn you up front. And by way of warning, I want to say that something happened to me recently when I was at the a conference, the TED Talks, and they do this profile page where you say some things about yourself, you answer some questions, and then you upload a little bio to the screen. And I did that, and then I got this message that said, "The text you have entered has been deemed offensive and cannot be saved." And this is my life. This is my bio, my career. Has been deemed offensive. So this is what you have here. Anyway, this book, Adventures on the Alimentary Canal. The Alimentary Canal is kind of an old-timey phrase for, it's not just the digestive tract. It includes above the neck, the pie hole is included. The pie hole, the feed chute, everything from nose to tail. And it's people and stories and science and I go off on tangents, but I like the term alimentary canal because it's kind of like the Panama Canal. It's kind of like, I like to evoke this sense of travel to exotic locations, you know, and something that's as pleasant as a cruise down the Danube. I don't want people to be like, ooh, it's going to be gross and disgusting in there. I'm like, come on, follow me. So that's kind of what I'm about with this book. And I do like to go to sort of taboo places. The human body, there are a surprising number of taboos. No one wants to think about cadavers, which was the first book. Sex is also, people are like, ooh, I don't know if I want to be seen buying a book that's about sex. And so sexual, and particularly sexual physiology, you know, like bringing people into a lab to study them as sexual creatures was like an awkward scenario. So that book was a little taboo. And then this one, and I don't really have a, it's not like I have a lofty goal with my books, but I would like to kind of replace a little bit of the revulsion that people, or the reluctance to go there that people have for this topic. I'd like to replace that with a little bit of awe and respect. And by way of doing that, I'm going to read you something right now. I did not write this particular passage. This is from a 1962 issue of the American Journal of Proctology. They say man has succeeded where the animal fails because of the clever use of his hands. Yet when compared to the hands, the anal sphincter is far superior. If you place into your cupped hands a mixture of fluid, solid, and gas, and then through an opening at the bottom, try to let only the gas escape, you will fail. Yet the anal sphincter can do it. The sphincter can apparently differentiate between solid, liquid, and gas. It can apparently tell whether its owner is alone or with other people. Whether its owner has his pants down or up. No other muscle of the body is such a protector of the dignity of man, since so ready to come to his relief. So a round of applause for the human anus. And while we're here at the anus, I want to read something. I want to just take, this is just my, it is an excuse for me to be able to read this particular footnote. I always like to share one footnote, my footnotes. There are people, I think, who buy my books and only read the footnotes. And that's really fine. So this is a footnote that I kind of enjoy. And it has to do with, there's a term per anum, which means via the anus. Okay. There's another term that is very common, per annum, which means yearly. Okay, and sometimes these get mixed up. Okay, the correct answer to the question, what is the birth rate per annum, is zero. One hopes. The internet provides many fine examples of the perils of confusing these two terms. The investment firm that offers 10% interest per annum is likely to have about as many takers as the Nigerian screenwriter who describes himself as capable of writing 6 movies per annum, or the Sri Lankan importer whose classified ad declares 3,600 metric tons of garlic wanted per annum. So anyway, I like to have for every chapter in the book, and in this case, it's kind of arranged sequentially from, well, nose to tail. And I like to kind of have a stop along the way, like a narrative setting. I like to talk to someone or go somewhere. I like to have a bit of dialogue, a little bit of narrative story. So some of the chapters, this was easier than others. Like for the nose, I spent time with a sensory analyst who's like a professional nose, somebody who can does this kind of olfactory forensics, where someone can bring some olive oil where something has gone dreadfully wrong, and she's trained in olive oil and all the different flavors. And flavor happens mostly in the nose. Taste is on the tongue. It's just sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and that other one, umami, and everything else. That's all going on in the nose. So she's this professional nose who can sniff and taste an olive oil, say, or a beer or a wine, and notice an off flavor and know, okay, I'm getting diaper/manure baby vomit, which is a term, really a defect, an olive oil defect, in the category of fusty. And she can go, okay, I'm getting manure baby vomit. Pig farm waste pond, I think, was another. Yeah, you really don't want that. So she can go, okay, I'm getting that. So that means somewhere in your storage tanks, you've got some sediment that's rotting. So that's what's going on. So she's incredibly valuable to these different industries because she can help them sleuth what went wrong. So that was the nose chapter. The mouth and taste, I spent some time at a company that makes pet food palatants. And that is, the coating for kibble, the thing that makes the animal go, like, ooh, wow, this is really tasty. Very similar to, on a Cheeto, the coating. Because a Cheeto without its coating has no taste. I know someone who's tried one, who's in the business. But anyway, so they have consumer panels, like as they do with human food. They have animals that try the food, and rather than fill out forms, they have people who can interpret the behavior of the dog or cat. So that was the taste and mouth chapter, and that was a very interesting afternoon. The stomach, I spent some time with a gastroenterologist who brought a competitive eater, into the lab and a normal eater, put them in front of a fluoroscope, which can sort of take a movie of what's going on, had them got a bunch of hot dogs and a side of barium so that it would show up, and had them eat these hot dogs and was able to see what was going on. So that was also very fascinating. And we move along the way. And then I got to the rectum, and I'm like, where am I going to go? Who am I going to talk to? What? Let's see. Well, what does the rectum do? It's actually Donald Trump. Yeah, that would have been good. Why didn't I think of that? So for the rectum, I thought, okay, what does it do? It's a storage facility. It's a holding tank. And I thought, okay, who would have an interesting perspective on that? And I thought, okay, well, sometimes people smuggle contraband using the alimentary canal. So I called the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, the Public Affairs Office, in fact. And I didn't call. I sent an email, and I tried to explain myself as best I could. I'm doing a quirky book about the alimentary canal, and now I'm in the rectum part, and I know you have some issues with contraband smuggling, and thought, you know, it'd be interesting to talk to someone. Incredibly, this guy wrote back right away and said, yeah, at Avenal State Prison, we have some problems with hooping, which is, hooping is slang for rectal smuggling. It's like through the hoop. Keystering is the other term. Said, yeah, we have a lot of hooping of cell phones going on. People go off on work detail and they come back in. You're not allowed to have cell phones in prison. Tobacco also gets hooped a lot. Lots and lots of tobacco is hooped. And that's smuggled back in. And he was very accommodating. He said, oh, yeah, you can talk to the staff and we can set up an interview with one of the people, one of the inmates who's kind of known for his talents. And then he said, Will 4 hours be enough time? So I'm like, yeah, to talk to a stranger about his rectum. I think so. That was an interesting. He turned out to be he was in for murder, which I didn't know until I got there. And I had a lot of very awkward questions. Some of them I crossed off when I found out what he was in for. This is also by way of saying, introducing, I have a special offer tonight. If anybody buys two books, I had made, this is a cell phone pouch, okay, and it is the approximate dimension of the human rectum, okay, and I had it printed with the first line of the chapter. It says, should circumstance prevent a man from carrying his cigarettes and cell phone in his pants pocket, the rectum provides a workable alternative. I had these ordered, and they didn't ask me any questions. They just go like, okay, when do you need them by? I kind of expected this to be a really awkward business transaction. But it was fine. So, two books and you get the commemorative rectal cell phone. It's also, you can also put sunglasses in it. You can put them where the sun don't shine. I thought I would talk a little bit about... let's go back above the waist a little bit. I wanted to talk. One of the chapters I found kind of amazing, the topics, is saliva. And because saliva, I don't know, spit, big deal. Well, I don't know, who cares? But I found this woman in the Netherlands, this beautiful Italian woman, Erica Saletti. And she has studied saliva for a long time, and she knows a lot about it. And she has this tremendous enthusiasm for saliva. And I do too now, and I'm going to share it with you. I'm a saliva convert. It's not just, because people think, oh, it's just, it moistens the stuff and it helps you form the bolus that you're swallowing. That's what they call it, the bolus, which is a fine, fine word, bolus. Second only to borborygmi, which is a word for intestinal rumblings, borborygmi. Anyway, so the bolus, you need saliva to form your bolus. You break the food down and you put it back into the swallowable state. Another technical term, the swallowable state, which I think that Rhode Island needs to have on their license plate. I still haven't heard from Rhode Island. I keep thinking somebody's from Rhode Island is going to not like that. So saliva, yeah, it does that, yeah. But it also does, she did this demonstration that's really, and you can all do this too and when you leave here, or now if you depending on if you have a flask with you. But if you have, okay, if you take, she put a couple drops of vinegar on my tongue, and she goes, pay attention, pay attention. And this gush of saliva, because it comes into your mouth, because vinegar is very acidic, as is wine, cola, citrus juice. And you drink any of these things, if you're paying attention, you will feel this sudden like gush of saliva. So it's like saliva coming in to dilute the acid, which will otherwise dissolve your tooth enamel, your tooth, like soften it and dissolve it. And you see, if people have problems with generating saliva, if they have a condition that, or it's been destroyed by radiation, their teeth just completely, their brown lesions, they wear away. It's really quite dramatic. So anyway, saliva is like the cavalry coming in every time you put acid in your mouth. Saliva's got antibacterial properties, antiviral properties. So it is this amazing. Oh, also laundry detergent. When they say enzyme action, those are digestive enzymes. They are like the enzyme that breaks in saliva that breaks down starch. There's also the one that breaks down fat and protein, which makes sense because the food you put in your mouth, it's the food you drop in your lap. So it makes a certain amount of sense. And somebody had the bright idea. Well, let's put those enzymes in the laundry detergent. And I learned about this by calling up the Soap and Detergent Association. And they said to me, yeah, because I said I'm writing about saliva and I understand the enzyme in saliva is also in detergent. And the guy goes, yeah, well, you need to talk to Dr. Luis Spitz. Seriously. I do not make these things up. This book is full of these. And then this was the most amazing part. I contact Luis Spitz and he says, yeah, I don't really do detergent. I do soap. You need to call Keith Grime. And here too, no glee whatsoever. I mean, I'm just beside myself. And he's like, yeah, here's his phone number. I'll just do one more, okay? The guy who did my very first colonoscopy, and I didn't set this up this way, his name is Dr. Turdeman. Sir, there are like so many, I think there's a word, someone told me there's a word, it's like aptonym or something. There's a word for when someone's name is sort of what they do. Anyway, and the other thing with saliva is it's kind of a weird philosophical thing, okay, because it's, when it's within the body, nobody has any problem with it. Like a lot of the body products, as they're called by scientists, body products. It sounds like a spa item. We have a line of body products. So body products, we are okay with them when they're inside the body, but as soon as they're outside the body, even if they're our own, suddenly we're disgusted. There's this researcher, wonderfully eccentric guy in Philadelphia, the University of Pennsylvania, Paul Rozin, studies disgust, the psychology of disgust. And he did this one experiment where he had subjects imagine your favorite bowl of soup and how likely are you to eat this soup and enjoy it. Okay, everybody's like 10 on a scale of 1 to 10. And he's like, okay, now imagine that you just spit into the soup and how likely are you to enjoy it? Okay, it goes down to like 1 because once it leaves the body, nobody wants anything to do with it. And people who study saliva, there's a guy in the Netherlands in Food Valley, which is like the Silicon Valley of food, in Food Valley. And he studies the rheology and of semi-solids, like custard. He studies like what happens in saliva. When you add saliva to something that's sort of starchy at custard, it makes it very watery and it also changes it. It releases some of the, it becomes more flavorful. So he wanted to do this study where you had people taste this custard before and after it was mixed with saliva. But if he had them spit into it, they wouldn't go near it. So he had to take this, he had to like secretly have them give a saliva sample, not really say why. And then behind their backs, like, add it like a spiteful waitress and then give it to and see how the flavor had changed. So it makes it very hard for him to do his job. But the guy, Paul Rozin wrote this paper about the microanatomy of disgust and talking about how, okay, where does it, is the tongue, even if you stick your tongue out of your mouth with food on it, will you then pull it back into your mouth or is it gross? No, you will pull it back in. So the self extends to the protruding tongue. And then he talked about how you include within the self, your loved ones, your children, your lover. You don't have any problem with their saliva or even some of their other body products. So it was, you know, it became this kind of weird philosophical discussion. This is all just spit. It's just spit, but nobody really wants to, nobody wants to go there. So there's all this really kind of fascinating material because I went there. publicity efforts for this book were not entirely without their challenges. The very first publicity was 3 months before the book came out. There was a media lunch, which is they invite the editors of different magazines and newspapers to come to this lunch, and I do a little talk. And I wrote a note to my publicist, Erin, who's a lovely person and very, you know, she's very, she's just a little cleaner than I am, maybe I could say. Or, I don't know. I wrote her this note saying, in my way, saying, Erin, I was just wondering, should I tie the content of the talk to the menu for the meal? It would be easy enough. Just make sure that there's beans on the menu so I can predict what will happen in 5 hours and whether men or women are more flatulent. And I could also introduce people to topics like intraoral bolus rolling and the miraculous gush of saliva that protects your tooth enamel when you drink something acidic. And she wrote back almost immediately, Dear Mary, I love that you're having fun with this. But I think, for the purposes of this lunch, we don't want to be too graphic. Perhaps you want to highlight the olive oil tasting chapter. Fortunately, Erin isn't here tonight. So we can talk about flatulence a little bit. And I like this topic because, well, not entirely because I'm a 12-year-old boy at heart, but that may be part of it. But I think actually, you know, I think I write about things. People say, "Oh, you know, what's wrong with you? Why do you write about these things? You know, why do you think other people would be interested?" And I'm like, I think that I write about the things that everyone finds interesting until they realize they're not supposed to find these things interesting. I think that there's a little of that, but maybe I'm wrong. Anyway, so the issue of flatulence, I like this question because it, and the issue of like men versus women specifically, it highlights the surprisingly complex technique of the techniques that are used to gather and measure flatulence. And it has something that has been studied. It wasn't studied forever, but the very first study took place in Paris. There was a Dr. Majandi who... sometimes the doctors in Paris would have access to the people who'd been guillotined. And I know this because in Stiff, I wrote about one the heads would go to this one guy, Jean-Baptiste Vincent Laborde. So he'd get the heads. And I was just like 10 years later, I'm like, oh my God, I found the guy who got the bodies. And it was this guy, Majandi, and it was kind of ingenious, although gory. He realized these are people, he knew what their final meal was. He knew what their last meal was. So he knew what they'd eaten. And then he looked at how much gas there was and what kind of gas. And so that was the very first effort to look at intestinal gas. And then fast forward to the 1950s, there was a guy in England, in Stratford, in Camden. Camden is near Stratford-on-Avon. And, this guy developed a technique that you would kind of think that would be the logical thing, which is the rectal tube. It's a tube with a balloon, kind of I think it was sort of on a pole, like an IV pole. And he said that people would wander around the grounds in their hospital gowns. And the researcher's name is Colin Leakey. It's possible that he pronounces it Colin, but I don't care. So Colin Leakey had the rectal tube, but that technique, later researchers dismissed it as uncomfortable and tending to clog. So that was dismissed. Now we fast forward to Michael Levitt. Michael Levitt is a researcher in Minnesota, the VA hospital there, who has... published 34 papers on human intestinal gas over the years, most of them early in his career. It was the first thing. It was the gas chromatograph had just been invented and was just coming into use, and people were using it in different ways. And he was the first to go, hey, what if we used it on flatus? And he did that, and he made a name for himself. He even published in the New England Journal of Medicine, with this the work that he'd done with the gas chromatograph and flatus, and he identified the main constituents, and he identified what it is that makes them smell, which is sulfur compounds, like hydrogen sulfide is the main one. But then he went on to do other work, and so then people like me, he did a lot of work with intestinal stirring, which is in the small intestine, the villi, the little kind of like terry cloth in there. It's like more these little projectiles increase the surface area as the loops in the terry cloth, so you can absorb more nutrients. And they move and they kind of stir the contents of the small intestine, and you have better absorption. So he was talking about that, and he said, "I wrote the book on intestinal stirring." I'm like, "That's so great!" And I asked a few more questions about intestinal stirring until I thought it was okay to say, "Could I see the mylar flatus trapping pantaloons?" Which he also invented. And he's, he gets really tired. And I said, even today, you know, because I said, "Well, you really did a tremendous amount of work. It's really impressive." He said, "Even now, it overshadows everything I do." At a certain point, he stopped returning my emails. He just got so sick of it. I had to, and I couldn't remember if his hair was partially gray, if it was still reddish, like how much gray. And so I looked up on Google Images, I put Michael Levitt in, and what, like, the fifth thing that comes up is a can of baked beans. So I kind of feel sorry for him. Anyway, one of the techniques that he came up with, and this is getting back to the issue of whether men or women are more flatulent. One of the techniques is very simple. It's called the flatographic tally. And that is simply, you have a piece of paper and a pencil, and every time you pass gas, you make a mark. And you count the number of times. But, okay, the reason this isn't fair to some people is that if you have a set amount of gas, okay, and you are the kind of dainty, ladylike person that lets it go in many, many little squeakers, you will have a very high flatographic tally. Whereas if you are the kind of person that lets the whole thing go in one basso profundo gale and mark down one. So it'll appear that the ladylike person is more flatulent, when in fact, they're probably about the same. So that technique is, you're going to get a very different result depending on whether you're my husband or my mother-in-law. the technique that is used most widely is called the breath hydrogen test, and that is you just inflate a mylar bag this way, not that way. And that's because intestinal gas is formed in the colon when bacteria break down whatever lands, the things that we didn't absorb in the small intestine. You know, the kind of, it's kind of like compost pile. It's the sort of fiber and bits and pieces that don't get broken down. Bacteria in the colon break them down and create a lot of hydrogen and some methane often. And some of that hydrogen gets absorbed into the bloodstream and then makes its way to the lungs and is exhaled. So if you know how much is being exhaled, you can extrapolate on how much is being farted. So the breath hydrogen test, okay, that would seem to be pretty pretty good, except that if you're my mother-in-law and you're holding it in a lot, you're going to absorb more in your blood and therefore exhale more, and here again appear to be more flatulent than you really are, I think. And I brought this up with Alan Kligerman, who's the head of research at Beano, which also, Beano does its own research, not just Michael Levitt, but the people at Beano are also doing this. And I asked the head of research there, I said, "Don't you think that somebody who's holding it in is very, you know, embarrassed, aren't they going to absorb more into their blood?" And he's like, and he's a very quotable man. He goes, "I don't know, Mary. I honestly don't know the ultimate fate of a suppressed fart." This man also said to me at one point, "I don't know, when I get people down to the nitty gritty, I really don't know anyone who in their heart of hearts has any objection to the smell of their own." it's not as straightforward as you think. The further you go into a subject, even flatus, okay, the further you go in, the more complicated it gets, which is what I love about science in general. And while I was at Beano, I thought it would be interesting to be part of a study. Before that breath hydrogen test, they feed you, it's like literally a pint of chili. You sit down and have this chili, and then you wait a few hours. And not just anybody can be a subject. You have to, there's a minimum requirement. You have to be a producer. And I'm not ashamed to say that I am a producer. I believe my husband is an executive producer. I think that I want to read one other passage that's not about farts. It's a little more related to what I was saying at the beginning of the evening about why I was interested, why I think it's worth reading about this stuff. You know, it's an entertaining topic because it's a little fun and gross, but it's also, I think it's important to kind of know your guts. There is an unnameable feeling I've had maybe 10 times in my life. It is a mix of wonder, privilege, humility, an awe that borders on fear. I've felt it in a field of snow on the outskirts of Fairbanks, Alaska, with the northern lights whipping overhead so seemingly close, I drop to my knees. I am walloped by it on dark nights in the mountains, looking up at the sparkling smear of our galaxy, laying eyes on my own ileocecal valve, peering into my appendix from within. Oh, you know what? I forgot to say. Hang on. I got a colonoscopy without sedation because so I could see it. Okay. Let me start again. Okay, because I forgot. Sorry. Take two. Those who know the human gut intimately see beauty not only in its sophistication but in its inner landscapes and architecture. In a 1998 issue of the New England Journal of Medicine, two Spanish physicians, published a pair of photographs, the haustrations of the transverse colon, meaning that's just like the little entryway between the segments of the colon, side by side with the arches of an upper floor arcade in Gaudi's La Pedrera. Inspired and wanting to see my own internal Gaudi, I had my first colonoscopy without drugs. Okay, there is an unnameable feeling I've had maybe 10 times in my life, a mix of wonder, privilege, humility, and awe that borders on fear. I've felt it in a field of snow on the outskirts of Fairbanks, Alaska, with the northern lights whipping overhead so seemingly close, I drop to my knees. Blah, blah, blah. I read you this. Laying eyes on my own ileocecal valve, peering into my appendix from within and bearing witness to the magnificent complexity of the human body, I felt, let's be honest, mild to moderate cramping. But you understand what I am getting at here. Most of us pass our lives never once laying eyes on our own on our organs, the most precious and amazing things we own. Until something goes wrong, we barely give them thought. This seems wrong to me, strange. How is it that we find Christina Aguilera more interesting than the inside of our own bodies? It is, of course, possible that I seem strange. You may be thinking, wow, that Mary Roach has her head up her ass. To which I say, only briefly and with the utmost respect. Thanks. Thank you. I would like to answer as many questions as you all have, and really about this book, any book, my personal life, really anything. People have some really fun questions with this topic. Yes?
Well, first of all, it occurred to me that you probably, when people say too much information, you probably have never said that in your interviews.
Yeah, too much information, is not a phrase that passes my lips often, no.
Right. Social groups and national groups.
Yeah.
For instance, some groups,
very much.
You know, are squeamish. Not only there's inter-individual variation,
yes,
but what you can tolerate,
right,
like spit, stuff like that.
Right.
But I mean, look at a baseball player who commonly is spitting out tobacco juice.
Yeah.
So, you know, in certain situations, yes, it's
yes, disgust is, there's huge cultural variations. Yes, from saliva and spitting, I mean, depending on the culture, in Greek culture, spitting is a blessing. I mean, you're not launching a loogie. You're just going like, ft, like on a bride, on a, I don't know, anything you want to, like, protect them from the evil eye and wish them well. You spit on them. In other cultures, in Brahmin, in traditional Brahmin culture, it's to spit. to spit on someone is so defiling. I mean, to be spit on is like, you have to take like 600 showers or something. But even to be the spitter, you are unclean, and you're, because it's considered there's some blowback onto you, and you have to go and like ritually clean yourself. It's so defiling. It's like a ritual pollutant. That's the spectrum, and then everything in between. And what we eat, same thing. I don't remember who this was. Somebody had written this. He said, among the everything that is edible and safe, whatever it is, there's some culture that eats it and enjoys it. I mean, there in the Sudan, there's a lot of very extreme fermented things, like fermented heifer urine is a condiment, like soy sauce. It's a very popular condiment there. There almost is nothing. If it's safe and edible, somebody is eating it and enjoying it. The United States, we are particularly squeamish. We export all the quote variety meats, which is organs and brains and lips and tails and things. We just want, you know, the chops and the steaks, and the rest of the world's going, hey, I'll take that. You know, it's the best. It's the yummiest part. It's often with organ meats. It's the most nutritious. There's a lot more up in the Arctic where you can't grow fruits and vegetables. In the health educational materials, the fruits and vegetables group, because there aren't any up there unless you fly them in, it's got 60 to 90 grams of organ meats, because there's so much vitamin and minerals in organ meats that are not in the rest of the animal. Anyway, so yeah, a lot of variation for sure. That was a very long answer. Yeah. Oh, my friends wish there was. I'm particularly with this book, I became a really unappealing dinner companion, because I'd be doing this like, oh, when you, like somebody drinking wine, I'd say, pay attention, you're going to feel this gush of saliva. It's really cool. It's like diluting the acid in the wine. And the oral processing chapter too, you know, I'd read that the minimum number of chews required to ready a McVitie's biscuit for the swallow is 8. And I'd be like, I bet we could do it in less. I bet we could do it in 6. So it's just weird to think about your own, particularly your own chewing, what's going on in your mouth. Actually, I find more hard to deal with than, you know, I was at in Minneapolis visiting a doctor who does fecal transplants. And that the processing of that material to me was less off-putting. It's done under a fume hood. It's like just very simple blender operation. Oster. It's an Oster blender. And I contacted the Oster people for a comment. And the woman wrote back, "Hi, dear Mary. After reaching out to our product development team, we've decided we don't wish to comment on this." I think they need to own it. They are the blender of choice for fecal matter preparation for transplant. Anyway, is there any topic? Probably not. Yeah.
Did you meet your husband before you started writing?
Yeah, he's stuck with me now. I met my husband before I wrote my first book. Yes, and my husband is a pretty squeamish guy, really. So. A very, very, very good sport, particularly for Bonk. And in this book, he's a good sport in this one as well. Yeah. So.
Have you heard anything from Priscilla about the Elvis chapter?
No, I haven't heard from Priscilla about the Elvis chapter. Priscilla didn't weigh in. I didn't ask her, but Dr. Nicopoulos, who is Elvis Presley's doctor, tried to ask her about, you know, his Elvis's childhood. This has to do with whether or not Elvis had a genetic condition, paralyzed colon condition called Hirschsprung's, or whether it had more to do with the prescription drugs he was on. Very constipated man. Anyway, Priscilla has not weighed in. No, I think Priscilla, and I doubt that she will. She didn't even talk to Nicopoulos. She just didn't want to talk. Well, I guess I can understand. But I would love to hear from Priscilla about anything. Yeah.
Any interesting tidbits about gluten intolerance?
I didn't really get into gluten intolerance. There's it seems that there's something going on right now in our culture, and I don't know if it has to do. I mean, the rates of celiac are unchanged, and that's something you can do with a test, with a blood test, and it's something like 1 in 141 people. But there seems to be something that's a sensitivity to gluten, and whether or not that has to do with genetically altered wheat, or whether it has to do with the overuse of antibiotics, or whether it has to do with just it's everywhere and it's in everybody's head. I don't know which of those three. So, but definitely it is something big in our culture right now. But I don't have a chapter on it. No. Anyone else? Yeah.
Where do you get your inspiration?
Where do I get my inspiration? Like, how do I choose the topics that for me, it's almost more, I was going to say it's a process of elimination. It's a process of winnowing, let's say. There's just a lot of things won't work for me. I can't. Some science, I don't have a background in science, so I'm not going to go into something that is, I probably won't be covering particle physics. I won't be covering genetics, as I feel, and neuroscience, I feel, are without some kind of background, it would be tough for me to do that. Anything really abstract. A lot of what goes on in the science now is we're down to the molecular level. It's proteins and receptors and genes. And that's, you don't really have, you know, I'm still in the world of beakers and bodies on slabs. So there's not a lot of that still out there. I mean, I'm ferreting it out and trying to find it, but I know it when I see it. So I still like to be able to go in a room and see people doing things other than looking through a microscope. So a lot of stuff doesn't work for me. So it's, but sometimes like Bonk is the one example I can give you where I know exactly what my inspiration was. It was an issue of Film Quarterly. I have no idea why I was looking at Film Quarterly. I don't subscribe to Film Quarterly. But anyway, there was a reference to the colposcopic films of Masters and Johnson. I remember going, colposcopic? Doesn't have to do with like a cervical biopsy or something? What? And it turns out they were making films of the inside of a woman's body when she's being sexually aroused. And this is the 50s. This is and they're trying to document the whole human sexual response cycle from arousal to plateau to orgasm. So they're like, how do we study women? I know. Well, we'll just build sort of a penis camera with a light source and attach it to a motor. And I remember going, gee, oh my God, in the 50s, and they got people to come and do this. That will be my next book. Sex research. That will be my next book. So that was, it was a moment in time where I knew, but often it's much more kind of fluid and amoebic. Someone had a question over here. You did. Well, my mother-in-law typically looks pretty good. She makes a cameo, but it's never anything untoward. So I have my mother. She's great. My mother-in-law is a wonderful, very funny lady, and she's a very good sport. I had her in the last book. I quoted the way she says "go to the bathroom," which is she uses the verb to make. Do you need to make? Which is a lovely kind of obscure euphemism that you, with kids mostly, would say, do you need to make? Anyway. Sure. Okay. One or two more. Yeah. Oh, okay. Yes. It is very much like what it sounds like. You take a healthy person and you've got another person who has a chronic infection. C. difficile is it's a difficult bacteria to get rid of. It sets up housekeeping in the colon and it gets into the little pockets and it seeds those. It's got spores, I believe. It's hard to get rid of. Sometimes antibiotics don't work. And so a very effective 93% cure rate is to take fecal material from a healthy donor, and they don't know which bacteria it is. The other person, meanwhile, has been given antibiotics to kind of like clean slate as much as possible, and then it's a process of immigration. You've got this entire universe from one colon that is being put in and taking over in the person who is ailing, and within a few days, the chronic diarrhea has turned around, and it's really kind of a it's impressive because it works and it's inexpensive. Shit is cheap. there's no downside to it. So it's a rare medical success story that is, and it's become the ick factor kind of held it back a little bit. And also there's no pharmaceutical company to kind of usher it through the safety trial. So it kind of made its way along sort of haltingly. And so I was interested in that and why it took so long, because the agriculture, dairy farmers have known this forever, that you just, if you've got a cow that's ailing, you take some, put it in the other one, and they've been doing it for years. So that's a fecal transplant. So well, I guess one more. Do we have time for one more? Okay. Did you had your hand up? Yeah. I don't know yet exactly. I'm looking into a couple things, but there will be another one. I just don't know quite what. Thank you. Thanks.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.